President Obama is back in Iowa with stops in Newton and Des Moines today. On such trips, what goes into protecting the president? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. And later this hour, my guest is former U.S. Secret Service agent Dan Emmett. In his new book, he presents a behind-the-scenes look at how he personally protected both President Bush's and President Clinton. Before that, my conversation with Polk County Sheriff Bill McCarthy. McCarthy just returned from a week in Israel. He was part of a law enforcement delegation, learning how that country handles security and responds to acts of terrorism. An Iowa sheriff goes to Israel after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Polk County Sheriff Bill McCarthy has just returned from a week in Israel as part of a law enforcement delegation, learning how the country handles security and responds to acts of terrorism. McCarthy and 20 other law enforcement officials from across the country made the trip. It's a trip which is sponsored and paid for by the American Israel Education Foundation, a group that routinely takes members of Congress to Israel on educational trips. And it's a foundation affiliated with the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, a pro-Israel lobby. Now, this program, the Law Enforcement Exchange Program, or LEAP, was originally the brainchild of a law enforcement officer in New York City after the 9/11 tragedy. Polk County Sheriff Bill McCarthy joins us. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Now, we know Israeli law enforcement has been dealing with terrorism and learning it from it for more than 30 years. Broadly speaking, tell us more about the goal of this trip, having a sheriff from Iowa visit Israel.
Well, there was in point of fact, there were three sheriffs from Iowa. One was Paul Fitzgerald, who is the president of the National Sheriffs Association, and he's out of Story County. And then the second one was a past president of the National Sheriffs Association, Ted Comanches, and he's out of Marshalltown. And it was through the auspices of those two people that my name was recommended. And I was able to go with 20 other law enforcement executives, almost all of them sheriffs, but a couple of them were from, one was from the FBI and three officials from police departments.
And what locations did you visit?
Well, we visited from north to south. We went all the way from the Golan Heights, all the way down to the southern part of Israel, and we visited for some period of time Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and several of the several other cities, including that surrounding the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea, and sites such as that.
Mm-hmm. And what specific locations at these places that had to do with security were related to your mission did you go to?
Well, they took us to the actual border between Israel and Lebanon, and they are in a state of war with Lebanon. It's currently not a shooting war, but it remains a declared war. They also took us to the West Bank, where we were able to look at Syria, and they are also in a state of war with Syria, although they're not particularly worried about Syria at this point because they said Syria is preoccupied with what is turning into a civil war. We stood on the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, in both locations, and we observed the UN maintain a neutral strip between the two. That was where you had the Israeli army on one side, and the Syrian army, or the Lebanese army, depending on where we were at. And we watched, we just observed that security setup and how they maintain the integrity of their borders in that location.
What difference does it make standing there versus learning about this back here in Iowa through news reports? The things you just mentioned, you knew before you went. What insights did you have while there that you got because you were standing at these border regions, for example?
Well, it makes it real. It brings it home. It I think you get to see the danger, the inherent danger in how this thing has developed, and it helps you understand the proportionality of it as well. And throughout all of that, whether we were in that location or down by the Golan Heights, you realize just how vulnerable Israel is. It's a small country. They like to say that they were smaller than Vermont, and they also like to let you know that they are in a sea of a hostile environment from many in the Arab world who have professed to destroy them.
Mm-hmm. Did you also visit any sites of terrorist attacks?
We did. There was a famous bombing in Tel Aviv involving a bar situation where a number of military personnel were injured. It made national news. And it was during that period of time when I think they had sustained 300 suicide bombings.
Is there any takeaway for us here in Iowa, for you as a sheriff in Polk County, when you learn about anti-terrorism? Is, for instance, terrorism any part of your thinking, your concern here in Iowa?
Terrorism is an issue in my mind. I helped some years ago develop a response for Polk County, which we displayed to the federal government, and at some level has been copied by other medium-sized cities and communities. But it nowhere near encompasses what they do and how they live in Israel. We're not at that point yet.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example of what do you mean by not at that point yet. What happens in Israel? What do law enforcement have to do that is simply not the case here, thankfully?
Well, they live with the threat. And we saw that they in Tel Aviv, for example, they are a city of cameras. And I suppose you could say London is too. That's where we commonly have the perception that they have it covered with cameras. But because of that, they were able to play back some scenes of notoriety, some killings, and it's pretty gruesome. It's pretty gruesome stuff to see. And the realization is that at any one moment you can be involved in a shootout, and they are confronting those issues daily. They have certain abilities to circumvent, but what we call civil rights here, individual rights, I should say, that don't exist over there, just simply because of the necessity for them to combat those types of threats.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to go on patrol with the law enforcement officers in Israel?
We did. We were also able to visit with the superintendents in both Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and then again at a city called Sabat. And again, they have a difficult job to do. They're not afraid to do that job, and they're not afraid to frisk somebody or take whatever action is appropriate. But I must say this, though, in terms of their day-to-day crime, it doesn't seem to be at the level ours is.
Mm.
It is relatively low, although they say it's growing. It's the terrorist events that they worry about most.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned before the freedoms that they have. We often have the perception here that maintaining freedom is difficult, especially in Israel, because of the concerns about keeping people safe. So how do you find that balance, or how have the Israelis found that balance?
Well, I'll give you an example. We had a general who was involved in an attempted suicide attack, and except in this case, they were able to grab the fellow. They put his hands behind his back, and they handcuffed him immediately, and they nailed him down. They could not let him fall forward because he could engage the device. And they could not allow him to struggle because of that. And then he was surrounded by a sea of people in a resort area. They had contacted the bomb squad, and they said, "There's nothing we can do. It's too dangerous. You're going to have to put this fellow down." And the general said he gave the order to kill the individual. And he said he's had to live with that ever since. And he has nightmares about it, but he said, "You have to do what you have to do to protect the innocent people." And they shot the guy, they held him up, and then they were able to lay him back and carry him out and then disengage the bomb. but it was constructed in such a way that they couldn't do that while he was alive. So these are things that, by and large, American policing don't have to deal with.
Mm. Did you also get a sense of how everyday life for Israelis, people not involved in law enforcement, how everyday life is different because of the security concerns?
Well, they, you know, it's always in their forefront. It's there. They look to me like they live a normal life, but certainly everyone we talked to, and there was a good many people that we visited with, it was always something that was right out in front of them.
Mm-hmm. What would you say were the chief differences between policing in Israel and here in Iowa? You went on that patrol, you said.
Yeah, not a lot of difference. Not a lot of difference, except that you know, they can bring somebody in for questioning really without probable cause, and we cannot. They can take certain independent actions without court order, and we cannot. And except for those minor things, you're still dealing with people. You're still dealing with vested interest in communities that have spokesmen and the issues that cause people to bump together, whether they be Christian, Muslim, Israeli. You have those environments there, and so you have those differences that you have to deal with. And they, you know, that's what they're geared up to do, and they do it pretty well.
Mm-hmm. What are the experiences or the lessons, the insights that you gained there that you'll pass on to the others in your sheriff's department?
Well, it was at a prison, and quite frankly, it was a prison where Eichmann was held and then subsequently put to death, just as a side note. But it was something I had never heard of before. And if they have a hostage that's taken in a prison, and, I mean, they may deal with that hostage by shooting him and disengaging him immediately. On the other hand, if it's a situation where they think that they can save the hostage and the prisoner, they will use rubber projectiles, rubber bullets, except we are taught to shoot center mass in the chest. It's the most likely target, a likely point to hit somebody, because it's the biggest area when you think about it in your body. They are taught to start diagonally at the shoulder, run to the chest, down to the leg, and then finish up at the ankle. And if it takes 50 rounds to do that, they're going to fire those 50 rounds. And I guess there's a little bit of physiology here in their study, but they claim that you can steal your feelings about being hit in the chest like we in America does, and then proceed on with whatever it is you wanted to do, be it cut the throat of the hostage or not. Whereas the Israelis have learned that if you can shoot somebody with rubber bullets, which hurt like heck, and that if you can hit several points on the body in almost equal time, it's too many pain points rushing to the mind for them to be able to resist that, steel themselves, and move ahead with whatever act they wanted to do. I've got to think that one through and talk to some of the experts back here and see if that makes sense to us, but it's how they train.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, my guest in this half hour is Polk County Sheriff Bill McCarthy. He's just returned from a week in Israel as part of a law enforcement delegation, learning how the country handles security, responds to acts of terrorism. McCarthy and 20 other law enforcement officials from across the country made the trip, two other sheriffs in Iowa, as a matter of fact. Do you have any personalities, any people you met in Israel who will remain a memory for you, stood out?
One of the Israelis that were assigned to us, and by the way, we had three full-time guards that were with us at every minute, and they were armed. But one of the individuals that was assigned to explain to us the history of what we were looking at was an Israeli archaeologist who had been working on the City of David site, and that was extremely fascinating to hear him talk from a historical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
They also took us to the Dead Sea, where we were able to go to Masada and take the tram up to the top of that one of Herod's palaces. It was just fascinating, just totally fascinating.
Mm-hmm. The Israelis, of course, are known for their security technologies, high technology. Were you introduced to any of that that surprised you?
Oh, my gosh, yes. When I was in the Marine Corps, one of the things I did was as an 81-millimeter mortar man, and, you know, you drop the mortar in the tube, and then somebody's down the range about 4 miles, and they'll get on the phone and say, hey, idiot, you missed it by you're short a mile, moving an inch, and if you're moving an inch and you come up long, they'll say, idiot, adjust it again, that kind of stuff. But on the Scud missiles in Sabat, last year they had received 28,000 Scud missile attacks. It's so phenomenal, it doesn't even make the news anymore. And this was in the Golan Heights area. Now, having said that, the Israelis have developed 4 Scud missiles and early warning capability. And they can actually tell, they have 2 minutes that when they pick up this Scud launch. But by the time it processes itself through the computers and it tells them where it came from and where it's going to, they're down to 15 seconds. And they were very happy with those 15 seconds in Sabat because they felt that gave everybody there, who by law has to have a safe room in their house, a chance to find a secure place. Their only concern was a mother that may have 2 or 3 kids in a car. She's in trouble. But they are developing those early warning capabilities, those almost Star Warian-like capabilities, probably more sophisticatedly than anything we've ever seen any place.
The civilian population there does not ignore the warnings either.
Oh, my gosh, they don't. And here's the other thing, too. Every single person there has a responsibility to perform 2 years in the military. Every single member of their society, except the ultra-conservative Jews, and that's an issue they're going to deal with politically eventually, but currently every single person. So you can see the mindset across the entire country. What they field as an army, within about 36 hours, they say they can multiply 5 times when they call the reserves up.
So in that sense, we can't really speak of a difference between a civilian and a military or law enforcement population. They are all one team.
And because of that, even though they're very artsy and there's a high-level educational class, make no mistake about that, they're still more of a militaristic, conservative society.
Mm-hmm. Were you also able to travel to rural areas in Israel?
Yes, outside the cities, most all of it is rural. The most dramatic thing we saw, though, if I might add, was in Jerusalem, within the temple walls, where you had the underneath the Muslims' Temple of Gold dome, where they think that Muhammad rose to heaven. There is the stone where Abraham was directed by God to offer his son as a sacrifice and then stayed his hand at the last minute. And adjoining that are several Christian churches where Christ was crucified and where they believe that he was buried and rose from the dead, and it's all on top of itself. I had no idea of the close proximity of these sites.
How much contact did you have with Palestinians or Arabs living in Israel?
We did not. We did not. We did see the communities when we were at the Golan Heights, looking at down to the Sinai. You could see several of their cities. In fact, they took us to a certain point so we could see the church that sits on the birth site of Christ there in Bethlehem. But that's a city that's controlled by the Palestinians as well.
Mm-hmm. Bill McCarthy, I don't know how well-traveled you are or have been before this experience. Were you often abroad?
I was not, although I've spent quite a bit of time in the Middle East or the Far East. I spent 2 tours in Vietnam, and as a result of that, I was able to go to Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, and Bangkok and Thailand, so that's the extent. And then going to this part of the world was new for me.
Mm-hmm. So you've been back in Iowa for how many days?
Just about 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Has this experience changed the way you view our lives here in the U.S.?
Well, I can't say that it has, because we, you know, we are such a big and strong country, and while there are differences in our, you know, our abilities, and there is poverty, it's nothing like what the rest of the world has to contend with. And I had a pretty good understanding of how terrible a life can be from my experience in war-torn Vietnam. So no, I can't say that I'm surprised, but you know, certainly maybe someday we can all elevate to a certain point where we treat each other with the respect we deserve, simply because we're human.
Mm-hmm. Bill McCarthy, a last question, not related to your trip. President Obama is in the state this week. In fact, in Des Moines, at the state fairgrounds. What kind of extra duty does this require of you and your department? How does this change your day?
We help when asked by the civil service, and I can answer that if I can real briefly. When I was at Des Moines and was chief of police there, we got a lot of criticism for the amount of effort that we would put towards a presidential visit. And my response has always been to please think about that criticism, because these people, when they travel, the presidents of the United States, they bring the world with them. I mean, everything we do to market ourselves, isn't that what it's about? Secondly, I remind them what happened in Dallas, Texas, when John Kennedy was killed. 17% of the international corporations packed up and moved out. That would be devastating to the Des Moines area if that were to happen here. So let's not worry about what we spend to protect the president. Let's go ahead and do what we have to do to make him safe.
Okay. Polk County Sheriff Bill McCarthy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Bill McCarthy has just returned from a week in Israel as part of a law enforcement delegation, learning how the country handles security and responds to acts of terrorism. McCarthy was one of 21 law enforcement officials from across the country that made the trip, a trip sponsored and paid for by the American Israel Education Foundation, a group that routinely takes members of Congress to Israel on educational trips. Well, with the president visiting Iowa again today, we wondered what goes into protecting the president. Coming up, I'll talk with former U.S. Secret Service agent Dan Emmett. In his new book, Within Arm's Length, Emmett presents a behind-the-scenes look at how he personally protected both President Bush's and President Clinton. Protecting the President, when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Time is 12:28, and coming up at 1 o'clock today, talk of the nation from NPR News. Recent poll asked people who spent time in a hospital in the past year about the care they received. Only about half were very satisfied. The rest complained about the wrong diagnoses, unresponsive nurses, or poor communication. The problems in our hospitals, the topic in the 1 o'clock hour of Talk of the Nation today with Neil Conan. Later, Jared Diamond in the 2 o'clock hour, the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, a book that described why some societies built empires while others withered. We'll hear about why some new ideas succeed and others fail. Jared Diamond, 2 o'clock hour today on Talk of the Nation here on Iowa Public Radio. Flash Flood Watch continues until 1 for Northwest Iowa. Wind advisory today for Eastern Iowa.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. President Obama is back in Iowa today with stops in Newton and Des Moines. On such trips, or any time for that matter, the president's security is, of course, the highest priority. Helping to keep presidents safe from harm was the job of my next guest for many years. Dan Emmett is a retired U.S. Secret Service agent. He's also a former captain in the U.S. Marine Corps. Emmett served 21 years as a special agent in the Secret Service from 1983 to 2004. And in his new book, Within Arm's Length, he presents a behind-the-scenes look at how he personally protected both President Bush's and President Clinton. Dan Emmett joins us now live by phone from Alabama, I believe. Dan Emmett, welcome to our program.
Yeah, Ben, hi. How are you today?
I am doing just fine. Well, the president is in Iowa today. I wonder if you could start off by giving us an idea of the security that surrounds him and precedes him. What has been happening behind the scenes to make sure the president is safe in Iowa or anywhere he goes?
Yeah, Ben, you know, there are actually two phases to that. The first one being the advance phase. About 5 to 7 days before the president's arrival, the advance team will go out. And these are agents from the Presidential Protective Division. You'll have an agent that will do the motorcade advance. You'll have an agent responsible for each individual site. You'll have one agent who's responsible for the overall trip. And then each agent will have assigned to them a staff counterpart from the presidential staff who actually lays out the sequence of events and what's going to happen at those various sites. In addition to the Secret Service, you're going to have military explosive ordnance disposal, Secret Service magnetometers, canine units, counter snipers, counter assault team. So it's quite an entourage, Ben.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like perhaps hundreds of people involved.
It can be, depending on how many sites there are. If it's just going to be one or two sites, then not so many, but if you're going to be talking about multiple sites over multiple days, then it can get on up there. Then, of course, when the president arrives on Air Force One, he is accompanied by what we call the working shift. And those are the agents that you see that surround him and that go with him. And they're the ones ultimately responsible for his personal safety up close.
Mm-hmm. And that is a part of the team that you were on.
Well, I was a part of, yes, I served two tours on the Presidential Protective Division. First tour was with Bush 41 and Clinton, and then I became an instructor for several years training the new ones, and then I came back for W on his Presidential Protective Division.
You write in your book that you were 8 years old when President Kennedy was assassinated in 1963,
mm-hmm.
and it was that event that you decided after which you decided to become a Secret Service agent. And more than anything, you say it was a photo of Agent Clint Hill on the back of that presidential limousine in Dallas that made such an impression.
That's right, Ben. You know, I was a very impressionable youngster, I suppose, and that assassination and the assassination of President Kennedy just happened to hit me at one of my more impressionable moments, I suppose. And then that photograph of Agent Clint Hill, who was on the back of President Kennedy's limousine doing his best to shield the president and Mrs. Kennedy from further gunfire, that really stuck in my mind, and it never really left.
Why did it stick in your mind? Because you saw there someone at a moment's notice putting their life in harm's way to protect the president.
Yeah, I think it was the story behind it. I recall asking my father about it because I didn't really understand it. You know, I'm 8 years old. It's like I'd never heard of the Secret Service, and my father explained the photograph to me what the Secret Service does, part of its job, of course, protecting the president. And I just recall thinking, God, that sounds like a really important job, a dangerous job, and a pretty exciting one, and something I'd like to do someday.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about putting your life on the line, what are the obligations of an agent in protecting POTUS? You have to be ready to lay down your life without hesitation, act as a human shield.
That's correct. Of course, that's a last resort, and it's certainly not something that any of us wanted to do, but it's something that we were all willing to do, and through hundreds and hundreds of hours of repetitious training, operant conditioning, all of us certainly, I believe, would have done it. If you look at the previous assassinations and attempts that have occurred, you know, going back, Reagan, President Ford, George Wallace, who was a candidate, the Secret Service has always performed exactly as they're supposed to. And that's basically because of the superior training that each agent receives, not only when they come on the job, but throughout their careers.
How do you train for this? And how do you test a member, an agent, that they will actually react that way?
When an agent comes through training, of course, he's been through, he or she, because we have quite a few females on the job, they've been through tremendous vetting process, a lot of interviews, background investigations. So we start with the type of individual that we're pretty sure is going to do what is required when the time comes. And then you take that person and you subject them to the most intensive operant conditioning type training in the world. In other words, we put these people through practice attack scenario after practice attack scenario, guns on the rope line, knives on the rope line, organized attacks on the motorcade, until the mind gets to the point where it does not discern the difference between training and reality. And that conditioning has once again, as I said, really borne itself out to be some of the best in the world based on actual events.
And one of the examples you bring in your book is the attack you mentioned on President Ford, Squeaky Fromm, the pistol that she brought out. Was that in California?
Oh, that's right. Squeak, she was sort of there, sort of a random encounter. Happened to have a Colt 45 automatic pistol, semi-automatic pistol with her. She saw President Ford and decided that she would assassinate him. So she walked over, pulled up the weapon, brought it up, and as she brought it up, Agent Larry Boondorf, without thinking, automatically pulled the weapon into his chest, twisted it away from her, and subdued her while the rest of the working shift covered and evacuated President Ford.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, because it seems being an agent protecting the president can be routine. You hope it will be very quiet and boring, right? But you have these, you have to be moment at any moment ready to spring, as in the example you just named. How do you not get kind of lulled into a sense of false security?
Yeah, you know, it's over time an agent develops a sixth sense, so to speak, because keep in mind, Ben, that a new Secret Service agent, a brand new one right out of training, does not go to the presidential detail. They start out in field offices, and their introduction to protection is going to be with a candidate. It's going to be with a foreign head of state. And so over a period of years of being in certain situations where you have the likelihood of attack is more than others, you learn to your antenna go up and down and up and down. They retract and they extend. And so by the time you get to the presidential detail, it really is a sixth sense where every time you leave the White House, obviously you're on guard. You're prepared for anything. But there are certain situations that are more tense than others, such as rope lines with thousands of people crowding the rope line, many of which perhaps have not been through any kind of screening. And so that's obviously going to be a lot more tense than walking the president, you know, through the halls of the White House. So you don't really have to maintain that level all the time. It really wouldn't be possible. It's just over a matter of time you learn how to respond to certain situations.
Dan Emmett is my guest this half hour, retired U.S. Secret Service agent. Within Arm's Length, the title of his new book, The Extraordinary Life and Career of a Special Agent in the United States Secret Service. He was in the Secret Service from 1983 to 2004 for 21 years. You mentioned rope lines. Other situations that are ones that put Secret Service people most on edge when protecting a president, situations that, like rope lines, are inherently risky and you have to protect nevertheless.
Yeah, you know, Ben, anytime the president leaves armor, which is to say any time he gets out of the limousine. Because when he's in his vehicle, he's in armor, and so we have a pretty safe situation there. When he gets out of that, however, and starts moving towards the people, now you're in a whole different environment. I think back to the days when, and I talk about this extensively in the book, I wrote about it, running with President Clinton in the morning through downtown Washington, D.C., and with absolutely no idea who's out there, who's waiting, and it could be anyone. And we had become so incredibly predictable because we only had about four running routes, but that was probably the most dangerous thing that I did as a protective agent, because we're outside the White House, we're outside the car, we're out in the public where literally anyone could be.
And what in that situation, what scenarios did you plan for? Did you anticipate might happen?
Well, what we were most concerned with, Ben, was you know, just the general public, because it was known that he ran about 3 to 4 days a week. And so people would sort of gather outside the gates of the White House and along our known running routes and just be sort of standing there. And he was such a people person, and he still is, that when he would run by a crowd, he would reach out and, you know, shake hands or, you know, high five people as he would go by. And so we would close in pretty tightly when that would occur. And then we were also very concerned with other runners who would run up and maybe want to join in, and sometimes he would allow that. So, of course, that was a pretty tense situation. And so we were prepared at all times for really the worst case, which was an attack on the president when he was out running. And we, fortunately, it never happened, although there were a couple of situations where it easily could have.
Mm-hmm. Were you in any threatening situations with Bill Clinton or with any of the other the two presidents, Bush presidents, that you can recall where you were actually threatened or potentially threatened?
Well, you know, every time we left the White House, we felt potentially threatened because, once again, you never know what's waiting for you out there. We're totally on defense, and the bad guys are on offense. We have to get it right every single time. They only have to be successful once. Mm-hmm. And so anytime we would leave, we were certainly on our guard. I think that the most dangerous things we did, other than running outside the White House, probably the foreign trips, because so much is not within your control in a foreign country. You're relying so heavily on the Foreign Intelligence Service, on the local security people, and you really don't know who they are. You're just really having to take them at their word that they present no harm to you. And so those situations were always tight. I can remember certainly an incident that I write about in the book where we took President Clinton up to the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea within 50 meters of heavily armed North Korean troops. That was a pretty tight day within itself.
Mm-hmm. Dan Emmett is a retired U.S. Secret Service agent, Within Arm's Length, the title of his book. Are there ever any situations where a president wants to, or a president's people want him to go to a specific venue, make an appearance in a certain way that the Secret Service deems to be too much of a security risk? Is it, I guess what I'm asking, in any way a two-way street? Or does the Secret Service just do as it's told and make the situation as secure as possible?
Well, the way that we look at it and the way the president looks at it is that it's his job to be the president and do what he has to do to carry out that job, and it's the Secret Service job to protect him when he's doing that job. So for the most part, the Secret Service goes along with whatever he wants to do, and because that's what we're there for. Occasionally, there will be circumstances where the detail leader, the agent in charge, might turn to the president and say, "Sir, this is really not a good idea. Maybe we really want to rethink this." Now, he's not going to do that on a regular basis, because if you do it too often, the president's not going to listen to you. And so when the AIC or the agent in charge does recommend that we stand down from a certain venue, then the president's going to listen. And 9 times out of 10, he's going to go along with it. But generally, the president's attitude is, "Hey, you know, it's I'm the president. You're the Secret Service. I got my job. You got your job. So just take care of me like you're supposed to do." And that's kind of how it works.
You were a special agent in the Secret Service from 1983 to 2004, over two decades of service. I wonder, in that time span, can you judge whether presidents are more secure, safer than they used to be, considering the advances in technology? Of course, the bad guys also enjoy advances in technology, but overall, can you say that things are moving toward a more safe environment for a president?
In my opinion, and keep in mind that's all this is that the president is safer today than he has ever been before, really since 9/11. The Secret Service protects the president much the same as they always have, but as you say, with the advances in technology and so on, it makes it very, very difficult for someone who means him harm to get close enough to really do something. Now, you have to keep in mind also, Ben, that if a person is willing to give up their own life for that of the president, in other words, if a bad guy is willing to give up his own life, then you're dealing with a whole different animal there. And that's going to be a lot more difficult. But I would say that the president today is probably safer than they've ever been. I think the agents, the quality of the agents today, and I helped train over 2,000 of them, are higher, the quality higher than it's ever been. I know the training is better than it's ever been. And these young men and women that are out there surrounding the president are totally committed to that mission.
Dan Ammett, you write in your book about your first days on the job in 1983 about how you were told the fastest way to get into trouble was by violating the three B's.
Yeah.
Booze, broads, and Buicks.
That's right.
Meaning you don't combine alcohol with women and the government car. You also write, during off-duty hours, an agent was expected to have a healthy appetite for socializing, where bending the three B's was expected to occur from time to time. Now, given that comment in your book, and your book was written before the Secret Service agent scandal in Colombia that's been in our news, I'm interested, though, in your thoughts on the alleged behavior of the agents, hiring prostitutes, bringing them back to the hotel after the as a wheels-up party when the president had left Colombia. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, you know, what's happened in Colombia certainly has gone well beyond the three B's. The three B's was really just a warning from the special agent in charge to a brand new agent who was just coming on board how to stay out of trouble, you know, because Secret Service agents do work alone so much of the time that the senior agent would just simply say, son or young lady, here are the three quickest ways for you to get yourself in trouble. Stay away from these things. In terms of the specifics that happened in Colombia, really until all of the dust from that investigation is settled, you know, I really don't think it's appropriate for any former agent to comment on it. I think that it can probably only just muddy the water at this time. But once the postmortems begin, I think a lot of us would probably enjoy offering our opinions on what's happened.
So you can't tell me if you feel it is, if it did happen, that the alleged behavior, if it's an aberration or actually part of the culture?
Well, in terms of the actual events that occurred over there, I'm not going to comment. But I have said in previous interviews, and I'll say again, that in my view, it is not a part of the culture, that it is an aberration, that during my time on the presidential detail, these things did not occur. There's a big difference between what happened over there and just having a few drinks after work, you know, and then going out to dinner and then hitting the rack, which is pretty much what we did. We were always too tired to really do anything more than that. So let's just see what happens. I know that the director was on the Hill yesterday, but this is far from over. I think we're probably several weeks or maybe even months from this being totally settled. So yeah. I just prefer to stay away from the specifics at this time.
Now, in writing this book, I wonder if you had to get approval from the Secret Service or the government about what you could or couldn't write about. Are there things in this book or things not in this book that that were forbidden to write about?
Well, the only things, first of all, the Secret Service is a law enforcement agency. It's not an intelligence service. And this is a mistake that a lot of people have made in the wake of Colombia. A large part of the world seems to believe that Secret Service is like the CIA, but it's not. Secret Service is law enforcement. CIA is an intelligence is part of the intelligence community. There's no set requirement. In other words, you don't have to get permission to write a book about the Secret Service like you do at the agency. That has to go through the Publication Review Board if you're a former agency officer. But at Secret Service, you can write anything you want as long as you do not violate your non-disclosure agreements. And what I mean by that, anything that you were briefed in on that is considered secret or at the top secret level.
That could potentially harm national security.
Correct. If it jeopardizes national security or sources and methods, then you cannot. Now, what you're strongly discouraged from writing about, but you could if you wanted to, would be any private things about protectees. And I deliberately stayed away from that. There have been books written in the past that dealt with nothing but dirty laundry about presidents, protectees of the Secret Service. And, you know, I just really don't think that an agent should be talking about those things. That there's plenty to talk about in terms of an agent's career without talking about the personal lives of the people that he protected.
We have just a few seconds left, but we have to mention here, too, one of the personal things you do mention, which is well within bounds, is that you met your wife as part of this work, and she's also a retired Secret Service agent.
That's right. Ben, you know, my wife and I, we met when I was assigned to the New York field office, and we were married about a year later, and we're still at it.
Very good. Okay, we have to go now. We want to thank you so much for this conversation. Dan Emmett, retired U.S. Secret Service agent of 21 years, his new book, Within Arm's Length. Dan Emmett, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Ben. I enjoyed it.
All right. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Catherine Perkins, and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available anytime at our website. Perhaps you caught part of this conversation, part of this hour, want to hear the whole thing. We've got it there for you on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Write us anytime. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.